Aristotle, Part 4. The 16th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas was presented by Jack Crabtree on March 6, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 5 in this series.
Okay, let's get started. We'll finish Aristotle. We'll move on to Hellenistic and Roman philosophy. So in your notes, we're on page 4 of the Aristotle notes, Ethics, E. We talked about this a little bit. In the Nicomachean Ethics, which is his major work on ethics, he has two larger works, and I have not read the other one, but the Nicomachean Ethics, he begins by asking how do we get eudaimonia? And I think I talked about this a little bit. Eudaimonia, it usually gets translated happiness in most English translations, but that's not a particularly good translation, I think, or at least it doesn't work for me because happy seems like a rather superficial reality, whereas eudaimonia is a deeper, more substantive, more significant reality. It would be something more like what we call fulfillment, how you gain fulfillment in your existence, or I heard a professor define it as human flourishing. Yeah, that makes sense to me. It's how do you flourish as a human being? And Aristotle argues that every philosopher agrees that that's the end of human existence. And by end, he means goal or purpose, what you're aiming for in human existence. You're aiming for eudaimonia. Where philosophers start to differ is, what is it that's going to result in eudaimonia or produce eudaimonia? Aristotle argues that some of the ancient philosophers were hedonists, and they believed that it's pleasure, maximizing pleasure, that leads to eudaimonia. Others made other proposals, and Aristotle, in the opening of the Nicomachean Ethics, he argues against and dismisses their proposals, and he ends up saying, ultimately, what leads to eudaimonia is what he calls virtue. Arete is the Greek word. Arete actually means something more like excellence. It's when you achieve excellence that you achieve your fulfillment. But they normally translate it virtue. The reason I point that out is because this side of Christianity, or for that matter, this side of Victorian England, when we think of virtue, we think of virtue as a particularly moral quality and moral concept. It's not necessarily a moral concept for Aristotle. It includes moral excellence, but there are other kind of excellences too. It's not unlike the Hebrew word for wisdom, chokhmah, I believe it is, which means excellence as well. So the craftsmen in the temple are described as being given wisdom by God to work with bronze or gold or whatever. They are skilled. They have a skill that gives them the ability to work to produce with excellence in that particular arena. Arete is the same thing. So Plato can write a dialogue, what is arete, and he can talk about the virtue of a flute player is to play the flute. So it's clearly not confined or limited to a moral quality in and of itself. So that might help then when we come to understand what Aristotle thinks virtue is. What Aristotle thinks virtue, excellence, is to achieve excellence in what makes a human being distinctive as a human being. And Aristotle is famous for defining a human being as a rational animal. And if you think back to the dialectic that Socrates introduced, you take major categories and then you divide them up, and then you divide them up again, and then you divide them up again. Aristotle uses that dialectical schema throughout his biology and everything else. So you have all kinds of animals, but certain animals have distinctives that make them this kind of animal rather than that kind of animal rather than that kind of animal. And then you can divide those further and further. Well, what is it that is distinctive about a human being that sets him apart from all the other animals? His reason, his rationality. He's the rational animal. Now, Aristotle also thinks there's other things. He's also a political animal, Aristotle will argue. So there are other distinctives of being a human being. But one of the most fundamental is his being a rational animal. So how do you achieve excellence as a rational animal? Guys across the street emphasize animality. Aristotle emphasizes rationality. That by achieving excellence with your reason, you fulfill yourself and flourish as a human being.
Okay, then if he thinks that rationality makes the person that person, does he divide it from there? Like, what does he do? Are there people in there, subgroups of people? I mean, what do
there
retarded
are.
People rate as?
I'm sorry.
What do retarded people rate as?
Well, they would still be human because they share this feature of human rationality. But then by nature, Aristotle would make a distinction between a slave and a master. If you are suited to be a slave, that's just what you are by nature. So the idea, I mean, this is very interesting. This leaves its imprint on the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages was a significantly hierarchical society with no mobility to speak of. No significant mobility. If you were born a serf, it's because you deserve to be a serf. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You were that by nature. Women were inferior to men, and they were that by nature. So
yes, probably some women are less rational than men.
Well, that's exactly what he's thinking, is that men have a higher dose or more intense rationality than women do. So therefore they are, I mean, literally more distinctively than females are. Slaves have less rational capacity than the master class, so they are less truly human. So, I mean, that is interesting. I mean, once you use that as a measure, then your humanity itself is called into question if you don't actually excel rationally. So it's really not until the breakdown of the Middle Ages where the idea that actually we are not locked into our social station by nature, that only comes about, and one of the big factors in that was the bubonic plague, the Black Death, the Black Plague, because it killed off so many people that you had all these positions that needed to be filled with nobody qualified, right, to fill them. So you had people from lower classes able to rise up and take those positions, and it completely changed their perception of human beings. All of a sudden, also the Vikings and the Scandinavian, the Germanic tribes were more intrinsically democratic, meritocratic. You know, you didn't become the chieftain of the Viking tribe, whatever, by birth, right? You had to earn your way there. And that kind of democratic impulse, as they invaded more and more, they brought with them that kind of attitude. There were several factors that came together at the end of the Middle Ages that broke down the Aristotelian, and it really is an Aristotelian worldview, Aristotelian worldview that your social class was defined by the nature of who you were, and it was locked in by nature. So the idea that you could improve yourself and become more mobile and socially mobile came later. So then, and I think I mentioned this last week, then there are two ways to be rational. For Aristotle, and this is kind of odd for us Christians to kind of come to terms with, but moral virtues for Aristotle, What makes a moral virtue is its rationality. It's the rational way to act. So being courageous, being loyal, being temperate, being modest. Well, that modesty wasn't much of a virtue for them. But the things that are truly virtues for them are so because they're rational. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But they recommend themselves to us because they recommend themselves to our rationality. So one way to perform and be an excellent human being rationally is by living morally. But that was the lesser way to fulfill your rationality. The ultimate way to fulfill your rationality was through contemplation. And this is, I think I've mentioned this before with Plato, you begin at this end of the metaphysics of what Plato and Aristotle believed, it gets kind of religious. It really takes on a religious flavor to it, that the philosopher was the one who contemplated the eternal forms, and in through his contemplation of the eternal forms or the eternal beings, coming to make intellectual contact with those was what really fulfilled your rationality. And by fulfilling your rationality, you're fulfilling your being as a human being. That's true eudaimonia. Now, what's not at all clear, I mean, with Aristotle, you don't have any indication of the kind of reincarnation schemes that you get in Plato and that kind of thing. So I don't know what he thought about life after death and, you know, whether you go to be with the gods and contemplate the forms eternally. At least I don't remember what he says about that, if anything. Okay. We begin with basically the capacity for goodness of character. It has to be developed by practice. So how do you teach morality, ethics? You teach ethics by putting yourself under the apprenticeship, if you will, the moral apprenticeship of an older, wiser man. Follow his example, follow his instruction, live the way he says to live. In doing that, you develop habits, so you habituate yourself to living according to a certain set of virtues. And then over time, having habituated yourself to those virtues, in time you begin to love that way of living, that way of life. And you really become virtuous when you love the virtues.
Took that long to get me the microphone. I'll try to make it good. But it's very short. So when you talk about goodness of character must be developed by practicing virtue, is that good character, like virtue, not necessarily a moral character
right.
in the sense that we think? So,
right.
So
yeah.
These English words that we're looking at here don't have the meaning that I think that they do.
Yeah, and that's the oddest thing when you confront Aristotelian ethics for the first time. I think I mentioned last week, I read the Nicomachean Ethics from beginning to end and went, this isn't ethics. I mean, what's this have to do with ethics? Because it's so different. It's such a different way of thinking about it. It really is very pragmatic. That is, it's what's the most practical, pragmatic way to be successful in Athens, really? I mean, in Athenian society, how should I live in order to get along better, be respected, be held in esteem by my fellow citizens, and therefore put myself in a position to be more successful socially. That's really what it's all about. And so for those of us who have been steeped in a Christian worldview, you know, it looks like, well, that's not even righteousness at all. That's not morality. That's not godliness. There's no sense of any kind of oughtness or obligation. That's what was lacking that made me go, this isn't ethics. I mean, what if I didn't want to be this? What if I didn't want to be successful in Athens? Then do I have to live this way? And I think Aristotle would say, well, no, not if you don't want to be successful. But of course he'd go, but why would you not want to be successful? I mean, don't we all want to be successful? But if you actually pose that question, if you become skeptical about the very goal that you're seeking to achieve, he has no answer for it, I think. And that's what's so significantly different about the Christian worldview, because we're answerable to someone who could crunch us and make our eternal well-being not very happy at all, because we are accountable to a judge, there's the force of that oughtness. You're supposed to live this way. Well, what if I don't want to? You got to do it anyway. But what if I don't want to? Well, then you'll be smashed. You'll go to your destruction. So, I mean, in the end, there's still a bit of a looking at the consequences as being the motivation for it. But the way we experience it in this life is the reason I need to tell the truth and not be a liar is because I need to tell the truth and not be a liar. Because it's wrong to be a liar. It's wrong to be a thief. It's wrong to be an adulterer. It's wrong to be a murderer. And it's the wrongness of it that makes that has its own force to it. None of that in Aristotle. It doesn't have its own force. It only has the force of how rational it is. And I'm repeating myself, but I think I mentioned last time that what Kant, who comes out of a Lutheran Pietist background, who has very much inculcated that truly biblical, truly Christian sort of sense of what righteousness is, he tries to get rid of Christianity and God, but the one thing that's clear to him is, but morality without oughtness is not morality. And so he tries to establish oughtness without godness, without God. And I don't think he's all that successful, but he's trying. I mean, at least I immediately relate to Kant as, okay, yeah, you're talking about morality now. Not sure you've found it in the right place, but that is morality that you're talking about. He calls it the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative. See, the hypothetical imperative would be, in order to achieve X, you must do Y. The categorical imperative is, you must do Y, period. I don't care if you want to achieve X, you must do Y, period. And that feels more like what is required of us in a biblical worldview. God is saying, do this, and you will live. The people who obey me, the people who obey my categorical pronouncements, the people who love to be the kind of people that I say you must be, those are the people who will be rewarded. Okay, so three. Sorry. Mm-hmm, sure.
So I think I'm getting a handle on what Aristotle's ethics is not, but I'm not sure I can articulate what it is. So it's not right versus wrong. It doesn't match up with the biblical worldview. Could you put it in a nutshell of what it actually is, what the goal of ethics would be for Aristotle?
Ethics is learning how to live in a way that's more impressive rather than less impressive, maybe.
Be all that you can be.
Yeah, fulfilling your potential. As long as be all you can be. I mean, it's not like there's not a standard, but the standard is the sensibilities of an Athenian gentleman in the time that Aristotle lived. So be all that you can be. I mean, think in terms of how maybe the blue bloods of New England and the early America would think about that. I mean, there's just certain values that you have, certain ways of behaving, certain ways of being that every other blue blood recognized. Well, that's just, you wouldn't be respectable if you didn't live that way. I mean, we would be aghast if you were to depart from kind of the stereotype of what an upper crust Anglo-Saxon, you know, New Englander lives like. That's what Aristotle is talking about. Is that an Athenian gentleman, there's a certain template that probably gets absorbed unconsciously by people in that time and place, but there's sort of a template, and you would lose respect. You'd be it would be dishonorable to not fit that template. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Perfect. Yeah. I mean, the whole sense of in the upstairs culture of Downton Abbey, the whole sense that there are certain things that you just don't do. I mean, like work. I mean, you don't work. Yeah, that's a great example. The kind of thing that I think he's looking at.
So I could the goal of someone like Aristotle?
Oh, you have it. Sorry.
Could the goal of someone like Aristotle or Kant be directed kind of at the idea of creating a better community? I mean, could that be a goal? You're just kind of saying he's being a good guy just to be a good guy. I think a lot of these good guys maybe have the sense that they're trying to evolve community into a higher order. Do you think that could be a goal of his?
Not in the way that will become commonplace in the 20th century.
So that was is a goal in the 20th century for some, but not. Yeah. You don't think Aristotle would have been motivated by that?
I hesitate to say no, because man is a political animal. I mean, what's really striking about Aristotle is, without the polis, you're not even a human being. You are utterly dependent on your interrelationships with the polis to even define your humanity. I mean, kind of like an ant without an anthill is not an ant, I guess. So in that sense, yes, by being virtuous, I am a good contributing member of the polis, as every human being who's excellent will be and should be. So there is that, there's very clearly that dimension to it, but it's not the kind of, the idea that, well, first of all, until evolution comes into play, in the 1800s, you don't really have that sense of progress that came alive during the Enlightenment. Aristotle has a much more static view of reality than any 20th century person does. So the idea that you're going to like improve the world or, you know, make a difference in the world and bring about progress or contribute to the progress of history, that's not what he's thinking.
Are you sure, Jack? Have you read Ecclesiastes? Nothing is new under the sun. Are you sure we just discovered that idea in the 18th century? I'm just poking.
I don't know that we discovered it in the 18th century, but typically in the ancient world at this time, they look backwards, not forwards. You read somebody like Herodotus or the Greek historians. They all look back to the Golden Age. And they have all this mythology about a time in the distant past where it was this golden age and human beings were like amazing superhuman type beings, and we have since devolved into a kind of stasis where we are now. But oh, if we could only get back to the golden age. So that backward looking is fundamentally different from the forward-looking that you get in the Enlightenment and on. Modernism is characterized by this optimism of progress. I mean, it's gone now, but when I went to Disneyland when I was younger, that carousel of progress and all the propaganda and hype that goes along with that was just a perfect snapshot of the Enlightenment mentality. You know, just give us a few more years and we're going to conquer. There will be no more poverty. There will be no more disease. There will be no more war. There will be no more injustice. You know, we get the United Nations going and we'll talk to each other and we'll get these warring parties to come to a park and have a weenie roast and we'll get all this stuff solved. You know, it just that the 1950s newsreels were filled with that kind of optimism. Well, that's not the ancient world. The ancient world recognizes there's something desperately wrong. We have fallen away from the golden age, and we're no longer there.
Jack, I'm trying to figure out what Aristotle or a follower of Aristotle would look like in our society today, what their attitude would be. It seems like we're saying that virtue is something that leads to success, or from Aristotle's point of view.
Mm-hmm. A certain kind of success conceived in a certain kind of way.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well,
maybe this will help. Okay. Now, this is not Aristotle per se, and I don't remember if he actually addresses this in the Nicomachean Ethics, but in Plato's dialogue, which one is it? Yeah, I think it's probably in more than one dialogue, but I believe the first place I ran into it was in the Meno, the dialogue called the Meno, and he asks to define virtue. And one of the definitions that the dialogue partner gives for virtue is, virtue is the ability to do good to your friends and harm your enemies. Now, you know, that's jarring to a Christian, you know, where Jesus came along and said, love your enemies. But they are advancing that as the ethics that is a good, sound ethics. A virtuous man is a man who can do good to his friends and harm his enemies. So wealth is a very important tool to the virtuous man for Plato, and at least in his dialogues, and I think for Aristotle as well to a certain extent, because wealth gives you the resources to do good to your friends and to harm your enemies. So what kind of mentality, what kind of vision of success lies behind that? Well, it's not like that's a mob boss. I mean, that's alive and well within our lifespan, where certain subcultures, you disrespect me, you die. I mean, that's commonplace on the streets, I think, in some urban cities. Don't you dare disrespect me. I'll pull out a weapon and kill you for disrespecting me. And not having the ability to do that would be a disgrace within that vision of being successful. So we're not talking Christian righteousness here. We're talking simply a certain kind of image, a certain kind of picture of what an honorable person would look like, and how he would behave and how he would interact with people, what his social relationships would be like. And if I don't have the wherewithal, either internally or externally, to fulfill that picture, that image, then I'm not honorable. I don't have arete. I'm not an excellent specimen of a human being. Did that help? Okay, and maybe this next point will help a little bit more as well. A famous part of Aristotle's ethical theory is called the theory of the golden mean. That where virtue is always a mean between two extremes. So if there's some trait, something, an extreme deficiency of that thing would be a bad trait, but an excess of that thing would also be a bad trait. I have to have just the right amount of that thing. It's the Goldilocks theory of ethics. Just right. Yeah. So I have to have the just right. So take courage. Courage is just the right amount of, I have enough oomph to be able to be a risk taker and be strong and go for it when I should go for it, but I don't have so much of it that I'm going to go for it when I shouldn't go for it. That's what Aristotle would call rashness. You're just being rash. You're not courageous. You're just crazy, right? You've just got so much energy you can't control it, and you're just crazy, a crazy risk taker. If you don't have enough of it, you're timid and you shy away and you don't have the ability to take the appropriate kind of risk because you're just too afraid to take the appropriate kind of risk. Well, that's cowardice. So, but somewhere between cowardice and rashness is courage. Now, that's one of the best examples that actually makes Aristotle sound plausible. When you look at other examples, I'm not even sure it sounds plausible, but even in that case, I really don't think it works very well, because it's not a matter of having just the right amount of oomph. What it's a matter of is having the wisdom, the reason, the smarts to assess the situation and know what's called for in the situation. Now, granted, it's going to include not allowing the fear to stop you from doing what's right, but rashness is not a matter of having too much energy. It's being foolish. It's not having the right kind of wisdom to be able to know what the appropriate response is. So even in that case where it seems at least plausible to think of courage as the mean between two extremes, I don't think it even works there. So I don't find any of his examples really very convincing. But he's committed to it, that a virtue will always be a mean between two corresponding extremes of where you're supposedly measuring the same quantity, the same thing. For Aristotle, moral action must always be a free action. So a person is not responsible for any action they take which is not free. I think that's commonsensical, less commonsensical, but I think basically right, is that ignorance is a limit on freedom, and therefore for him it's exculpatory. That is, if I don't know something, if I'm just ignorant of something, I can't be blamed for the impact of my ignorance on my action, because I was doing it in ignorance. Now, the Bible has a much more nuanced and sophisticated analysis of ignorance than Aristotle does, I think, because the Bible takes into account there's really kind of two different kinds of ignorance. There's ignorance because I don't know, and there's ignorance because I refuse to know. There's ignorance because I don't want to know. Ignorance because I don't want to know is not exculpatory. You are blameworthy for that ignorance, and sometimes even more blameworthy because the ignorance itself is an extreme of rebellion against God and godlessness. So Paul can write, I was something in my ignorance. But he's not letting himself off the hook when he talks about how ignorant he was. He's talking about how blameworthy he was because of his ignorance. Okay, then just two last, very briefly, he had a whole work on aesthetics. It's been a long time since I've read that. He's most famous for his work on tragedy, in his work The Poetics, his theory of catharsis, that the whole purpose of tragedy is to elicit pity and fear and other negative emotions in order to purge those emotions out of you. That's his theory of catharsis. So what the tragedian is doing, what the tragedy writer is doing, is giving you the opportunity through his tragedy to purge some of those negative emotions. Then in politics, he probably had a huge impact on the founders of America, in that I think his, of all of political theory in the ancient world, his probably comes the closest to what got enshrined in the Constitution. If you notice the chart there, you have monarchy on the one hand, which is a ruler by one person, an aristocracy is rule by the best people. Polity is what, he had different words for it, but some people call it polity, which is basically what the founders tried to establish in America. Corresponding to, okay, then you have democracy, which is rule by the people, but basically democracy to both Aristotle and Plato is by the mob, so it's kind of mob rule. Then you have oligarchy, which is rule of the few, not the best, but the few. And then tyranny, Hugo Chavez. So monarchy and tyranny are both ruled by one person, but monarchy, a good monarchy is the best form of government, and tyranny is the worst form of government. So the problem with the best form of government is if it goes bad, it becomes the worst form of government. Aristocracy is the next best form of government, But if it goes bad, it becomes the next worst form of government. Polity is only the third best form of government, but if it fails, it's only the third worst. So, I mean, there, like Nicodemus ethics, the best is the median between the extremes, politics as well. The polity is the best in the median between the extreme of monarchy, which is very good, and tyranny, which is very bad. So the right, the most prudent, the rational form of government to strive for is that median, which the best side of that median, which would be polity. What is it? It's a constitutional democracy as opposed to an unruly mob democracy, basically. Think of it that way, where it's the rule of the people, but it's within boundaries and limits that have been structured by the polis, the city-state. So the founders were emphatic that they did not found a democracy, they founded a republic. And the difference being a representational democracy, that was part of the safeguard, is we don't have it just be straight direct democracy, because demagogues can take over and it can get really ugly and pretty bad. The tyranny of the majority is just as bad as the tyranny of one person. Tyranny is tyranny, and they were afraid to death of tyranny. So representative democracy is intended to elect people who are answerable to the people, and therefore you have a democracy, but they're not subject to the same social forces and dynamics that allow them to be demagogued in the same kind of way, supposedly. Everybody can be proved wrong. So that's Aristotle.
And pardon me, you might have addressed this already in previous weeks, but back to the whole ethics not being ethics and morality the way we think about it, was that also true of Socrates and Plato? Or is there, I mean, I maybe I was just wishful thinking, but I was wishing that in Socrates there was some ethics in the and morality in the way that we think of it.
It's an interpretive judgment. I'm inclined to think at least Plato was probably more like Aristotle in his view of ethics, I would think. Socrates, I think, is a different cat. I tell the students here that I think Socrates was probably God's prophet to the Greeks. He just seemed to be on a whole other planet than a lot of the other Greeks and a lot of other people in the ancient world. Gorgias, if you read the dialogue, the Gorgias, it's one of the best sermons, most inspiring sermons I've ever read. It just, you know, you read that, and unlike a lot of the other dialogues where you have this back and forth with Socrates and somebody else, he just, at a certain point in the dialogue, he just takes off and starts preaching. And it's a wonderfully inspiring sermon. I mean, you go away from that wanting to be good. You just want to be good, because he makes being good sound so attractive and beautiful and wonderful. And it's just really inspiring. Yeah, a part of it at least. Yeah. He seems to be answerable to God. That seems to be a big deal to Socrates. So what we don't have is any kind of systematic presentation of his ethics or ethical theory or morality of Socrates. So it's hard to compare it exactly with the Bible in that regard. But the little hints that come through out of the dialogues suggest to me that I'd be a lot more at home with what Socrates thinks a person should live like than I would with Aristotle.
So my question is, all we have of Socrates was written by Plato.
Mm-hmm.
So do we even know if, and yet you say that Plato was more like Aristotle, and so his ethics would be different than what you maybe see Socrates as being. So do we know what Plato was doing when he was writing up the accounts of Socrates? Was he disagreeing with him? Was he being faithful? Was he using them as objects of how you're not supposed to think about it? Or all of those
all
questions?
All of all of those. I think he uses Socrates differently in different dialogues. And there's one dialogue where Socrates is portrayed as an absolute buffoon. And I think just Plato is playing with him and using Socrates as exactly what you should not be and how you should not think. Is don't be this and don't think this way. And then you have something like the Gorgias that, in my judgment, is probably a fairly accurate portrayal of what Socrates would really say and what he would really think. I think I see the seam between them. It could be totally wishful thinking. It could be totally by my imagination. But what's interesting is how many other philosophers you read through the ages who also think they see the seam between them. So I don't think I'm making it up. At least if I'm making it up, it's some kind of Jungian groupthink or something that we're engaged in. It's easy to get them mixed up. We barely have time to start this. So let me just orient you to what the next topic is. And then, what is it, 3 weeks when we come back, we'll start Hellenistic and Roman philosophy. The reason I say Hellenistic and Roman philosophy, and that's why I'm putting them together, is that there's really no real significant distinction. In fact, there aren't really any significant Roman philosophers. There just aren't. You think of someone like Cicero, but Cicero was probably a fine man, but he's not doing anything at all original in philosophy. What he's doing, they consider him an eclectic. He would take a little bit from Stoicism and a little bit from Aristotle and a little bit from a Cynic philosopher, and just kind of roll his own out of the elements from those other ancient philosophies. Doesn't really say anything particularly original or particularly insightful that he has not just gleaned from someone else before him. So you don't have any original Roman philosophy. And what you do have in Roman philosophy is very similar in flavor and in tone to Hellenistic philosophy. Now, what do I mean by Hellenistic philosophy? You have classical Greek, classical Athenian culture that gave rise to Plato and Aristotle and so many other things. I mean, that must have been an amazing time in history, that within a short span of time, you have artists and sculptors and philosophers and playwrights and statesmen, all of whom are very impressive in their accomplishments and their achievements, just within this fairly compact period of time. I don't know what was in the water, but it just produced an incredibly vibrant culture there for a while. Well, it slides, it begins to decline, and then not too long after that, Alexander the Great, who was a Macedonian, and Macedonians were wannabe Greeks who thought of themselves as Greeks but couldn't find acceptance by the Greeks. So Alexander, probably from a very early age, decided that he's going to show them. And when the time came and his father died and he took over, he went down the Greek peninsula and conquered all the city-states. And in the first test case was brutal, absolutely brutal. I can't remember which city-state it was, but he decimated it because they put up some resistance. And he said, we're not going to have any resistance. So when he finally conquered the city, he leveled the city. It was brutal. And then he beat the Persians. And the story of Alexander the Great is really pretty remarkable. One of my favorite readings in Plutarch is on Alexander the Great. And he conquers all the way to India. Doesn't go into India because a lot of people there. But he stopped short of going into very far into India. But the whole steppe region, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all that, down to Egypt, the whole Levant, Israel, that whole region. So he conquered the world. And everywhere he went, I mean, what part of his agenda was to spread Greek culture wherever he went. So he would conquer an area and they would establish a city state modeled after Greek city-states. Plutarch argues that's really kind of part of his downfall, is when he got too far into Persia and he saw how the Persians treated their rulers like gods, and that kind of began to get attractive to him, much to the chagrin of his Macedonian brothers-in-arms. It kind of went to his head, and he began to go kind of crazy with power and that kind of stuff. But until then, what was remarkable about Macedonian culture is how much they treated each other as equals. So he respected his men, fought alongside of his men, didn't play all high and mighty, and wouldn't allow himself to be pampered early on. One of the reasons they beat the Persians is the Persians had a completely different mindset. The Persians' mindset is there's the king is the head, and you take orders from the head, and the head tells you what to do. So you could have this huge, huge army, and usually it outnumbered the Greeks, but you'd have this huge army. But Alexander realized all you have to do is chop off the head and the snake's dead. And it's true. They'd get the king, and all the Persians would stop fighting. They didn't know what to do, so they'd stop fighting. Well, if a Greek military leader died, somebody else would take command, would organize the people, and they would keep fighting. And your virtue as a warrior is what you did individually, the courage and the strength and the accomplishments of as a warrior, as an individual warrior. So you had incentive to keep at it and to keep fighting. And it was that difference in mentality that allowed the Greeks to beat the Persians. Well, that mentality, the things that made Greek, is what Alexander wanted to propagate across the world. The Greek language, Greek culture and all of its features. So the reason the New Testament is written in Greek is because of Alexander the Great. Because Alexander the Great spread then the Greek language across the whole eastern part of the Mediterranean world. He took the different dialects of Greek and basically concocted them into a common Greek. That's why it's called Koine Greek, the common Greek. Concocted a common Greek that he would then spread to be the official language, the language of business and economics and government and so on throughout the whole eastern Mediterranean world. So by the time we get to the New Testament, Koine Greek is the lingua franca of that part of the world. Well, when we talk about the Hellenistic period, we're talking about the period that comes into being with Alexander the Great, basically, and with his spread of Greek culture across the whole world. So we're not talking any longer about classical Greek culture, Athens. We're talking about the world Greek culture of the Eastern Mediterranean world. Well, during that period, there developed four significant schools of thought in philosophy: Stoicism, Cynicism, Skepticism. I think I have five here. Yeah. Stoicism, Cynicism, Epicureanism, Skepticism, and I think I included Neopythagoreanism probably. Yeah, I did. So we'll look at, when we come back in the spring, we'll look at all of those. What they all have in common, and this is what makes Hellenistic philosophy distinctive, is historians of philosophy call these therapeutic philosophies. They are trying to address, I think I have in my notes, they're trying to address the question of how should we live, how should an individual attain eudaimonia, but how should we attain eudaimonia in this troubled world we live in? Unlike classical Greek culture, which was built on a relatively stable culture, everything is falling apart. Everything is changing. The whole world and everything about the world is in turmoil during Alexander the Great and afterwards. in his wake, he gives the empire, divides it between four generals, and they begin warring with each other. And it's constant warfare back and forth. A lot of loss of life, a lot of economic disruption. It's just not a very stable world to live in during this time. So what becomes attractive then is someone to come along and give you an answer to the question, how do I survive this? How do I live in such troubled times? I never realized how unsettling it could be until fairly recently in American culture. I mean, I think we're beginning to feel the throes of this kind of unsettledness. Everything is falling apart. Everything that we knew and thought was permanent and thought was solid is turning to mush on us. Constitution, not sure we care about the Constitution any longer. Laws, not sure we care about laws any longer. Not just the population, but our leaders, not sure they really care. They're not really committed to preserving the way of life that we have always known. And what I had never really appreciated is how unsettling that can be, how disruptive that can be to you as an individual, when all of a sudden everything you took for granted you can't take for granted any longer. Well, how do you live then? I mean, what are you supposed to do with that? That's exactly the kind of environment they lived in, and that's exactly what every philosophy that is spawned during the Hellenistic period is addressing, that problem. So it's going to be strikingly different from Aristotle and Plato in that they don't really care much about metaphysical speculation. Cosmos schmosmos, I don't care what the cosmos is like. I just want to know how to live. How do I survive? You know, so don't bother me with speculations about how many spheres there are and what makes the world go around and what the moon is made of. I mean, I don't really care. What I want to know is how I can live my life and remedy the unsettledness and the turmoil of my life and my situation. Tell me how to cope with that. And that's why they're called therapeutic philosophies. Therapeuo means to heal or to remedy in Greek. So, yeah. So that's what we'll look at. Those were the philosophies that were alive and around and contemporary with the Apostle Paul. In fact, Stoic philosophy will turn out to have so much common ground with the kind of Stoic philosophy. Stoic ethics in particular will have so much common ground with the kind of ethical teaching that you get the Apostle Paul, that there are many academics who will make the claim that Paul just ripped off Stoic ethics and is basically regurgitating Stoic ethics. I don't think that's at all right. I don't think that's true. But it's interesting that they make the claim. That goes to show how much common ground there was between the Christian ethics, the Jewish ethics of Paul, and Stoic ethics. So they're very similar. As philosophies go, they're very attractive. I mean, you ask the question, what would it look like to be an Aristotelian today? And I can't imagine being an Aristotelian. You know, the first church of Aristotle is not going to get off the ground very, very quickly, because it's so foreign to anything that we have in our life. I can't imagine what it would be like to be a follower of his. But I can imagine being a Stoic today. That would not be at all out of reach, or any of these therapeutic philosophies for the most part. They're a little thin by comparison. I mean, they're not as far-reaching and as exhaustive. They don't paint these grand, sweeping, cosmic pictures of how everything is. So, you know, when it comes to explaining them, once you get the hang of it, there's not really a whole lot more to say. And in that sense, they seem a little thin. But they are ethically rich, really. All of them kind of are. With the exception of cynicism, maybe. But maybe I'm too cynical. I don't know. But I think they're fascinating. You're welcome.